Welcome to Copper Country Today, heard Sunday mornings at 7 o'clock on 97.7 The Wolf, 8 o'clock on AM 1400 WCCY, and 9 o'clock on KBAR 102.3. Of course, WCCY also heard now on 99.3 FM. Our program is brought to you in part by the members of the Copper Country Education Association and by the Copper Country Veterinary Clinic, providing the highest quality in medical care to help their patients live longer and healthier lives. You can also listen to a podcast of our program by going to the Copper Country Today page at QNRReport.com. Now, in the second part of this morning's program, Sam Ali will be talking about the ongoing effort to bring the Georgetown University Energy Prize to Houghton County. Millions of dollars at stake in that, potentially, and there is a community meeting about that coming up Tuesday night at 5:30 at the Sheldon Grill. Sam will have more about that in the second half of the program. My guest is Dr. Terry Frankovich from the Western UP Health Department. Kids are heading back to school within the next 10 days or so. It's important to make sure that they are healthy and ready to learn and that they stay healthy through the school year. And there are several aspects to that that Dr. Frankovich and I are going to be talking about. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Let's start with immunizations, and particularly we're talking about kids that are going to be heading into kindergarten, going to school for the first time. What kind of immunizations should they have had by this point?
Well, you know, I guess we really, from the state standpoint, we look at kids' immunization status when they enter school in kindergarten, when they change schools. And again, the schools actually have to report on children's immunization status in seventh grade, for all children in seventh grade. So there's certain key points that we look at assessing kids' vaccination. And if we look at kindergartners, basically the key vaccines that we're looking at are the DPT or pertussis vaccine, and it protects against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. And kids should have had doses of that particular vaccine, usually at 2, 4, 6 months, 12 to 18 months, and then a booster at 4 to 6 years of age. Also, children that age typically have a polio vaccine, a measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and a chickenpox vaccine, unless they've already had chickenpox.
Now, some of those diseases are not real familiar to us at this point. I know when I was young, because I'm now verging on elderly here.
I know I'm running into that quickly myself.
When I was young, most of those diseases were still familiar. If not to me, they certainly were to my parents. Diphtheria, pertussis, what are those?
Right. Well, you know, you're absolutely right in that it gets harder, I think, sometimes to make the case to parents about having their children fully immunized, because so many of these illnesses are not seen very frequently anymore. And we forget that, you know, our grandparents or great-grandparents often had family members that they lost to some of these illnesses. And so the vaccinations have done such a good job at dropping the numbers of cases that I think it's partly public health and medicine's job in general to remind people that the only reason we're in the shape we're in is because of vaccination. So pertussis is whooping cough, and that actually is an illness that caused an enormous burden of cases in the past. And in fact, when you look at before the vaccine, which came around in the 1940s, there were over 200,000 cases a year of pertussis in our country. What we see now is there are probably about that many deaths when you look worldwide for pertussis, because so many places in the world there's under vaccination. So now in the United States we might see about 50,000 cases reported a year, but deaths are far less common, of course, but it's important that we keep our vigilance up. Young infants are the most vulnerable to this illness, and the ones most at risk of dying of whooping cough.
So, have I heard about some recent outbreaks of this disease again?
Well, pertussis has been resurging, and we've had, I think in 2010 in the Western UP district, we had quite a number of cases. I think we had well over 100 cases during 1 year, which is unusual for us. And every year, I can tell you, because I monitor across the UP, we see cases as well that pop up here and there, and there are probably far more cases than are ever tested and reported. So I don't know if people remember, but whooping cough causes this usually no fever, but causes this horrible cough. And they used to call it the 100-day cough because it lasts so long. And young children will sometimes do this very persistent cough within a whoop where they try and catch their breath in between. But not everyone who has pertussis does that. But the cough is pretty severe and very remarkable. And young infants are the most likely to get hospitalized because of it.
Yeah, the diphtheria, I haven't seen much, at least in the news. Do we ever experience that?
It's rare in this country now. It's seen in other parts of the world, not uncommonly. But in this country, diphtheria and tetanus are both extremely rare at this point.
And, of course, that leads to a certain amount of complacency, as you mentioned, because now we don't see them anymore, so we think we don't have to worry about them.
Exactly. And I think the same case really can be made for measles, because we, again, it's one of those illnesses that, used to be a huge number of cases per year. Essentially, when you look at before the vaccine, which came around in the 60s, everyone got measles. It was almost universal.
Yeah, I had the measles, I had the mumps, and I had, both kinds of measles, because we had the red measles, which was the hard measles, and then we had the black measles, or the German measles, they called them, which was rubella.
Right, and there have been some outbreaks of rubella as well, but the measles, it's kind of interesting. Again, before vaccine, everybody got it, but people forget that we had about almost 50,000 hospitalizations a year related to measles, and about 500 deaths in the U.S. related to measles. So it had a pretty significant impact on the health in the community, and for some people, they were left with residual problems like hearing loss and things after cases of measles. So now we see it pretty infrequently, but we are seeing it. And in fact, what we saw is just some cases of outbreaks in the U.S., even in the past year, and almost 600 cases so far in 2014 in the U.S., and almost all of them are related to international exposures.
And, of course, rubella, which was considered the lesser of the two, turned out to be the worse of the two because there are people living today with the results of what happened when their mothers got rubella while they were carrying their kids.
Right. I mean, rubella was a very difficult thing because, you're right, when pregnant women were exposed and not immune and became ill, their infants would basically, because of their exposure in utero, be ill and have complications because of it. So the good thing now is that because of that, women now, when they are in pregnancy age or certainly when they are pregnant, are screened for immunity to rubella.
Now, you mentioned that there are additional checks done on kids for vaccinations as they go through school up through seventh grade. What kind of follow-up treatments need to be taken as kids go through school in elementary school?
In terms of other medical care?
Well, or in terms of what kind of boosters do they need? When do they need to get those?
Sure. Well, basically when children get their boosters at that 4 to 6 years of age, if they've had all their previous ones done at the right time, then they're usually up to date until they hit about 11 years of age. And then when they hit 11, we look at a couple of additional things. Number one, at 11 years of age is when kids will get often a booster with the meningococcal vaccine. They'll get a vaccination with the meningococcal vaccine. Also, the HPV vaccine, which is a newer vaccine and a really important one. So I think because it's newer, the acceptance rate for it has been lower, so we don't have kids as well immunized with HPV as we do with, for instance, pertussis. But it's really important. I mean, it's one of only two vaccines we have that are truly cancer prevention.
Yeah, and I've heard recently, obviously, that this was originally recommended for girls, but I've heard that there may be some benefit for boys as well?
That's correct. Initially it was approved because we know that almost all cervical cancer is caused by HPV, by human papillomavirus. So the vaccine naturally was initially targeting women, girls, because we hope to prevent those cases of cervical cancer. And we know there are probably close to 12,000 cases a year of cervical cancer in the U.S., and about 400 women die every year with cervical cancer. So being able to offer that prevention piece to girls and women was huge. So the vaccine was approved in about 2006, I think, originally approved for use in girls and young women, and the indication has been expanded now to include males for a couple reasons. One is because obviously males are part of that chain that exposes females to HPV, so if males aren't infected, they are not able to pass HPV on to their partner. And also because we've now learned that HPV is related to other cancers in addition to cervical, anal cancers, and it looks like head and neck cancers as well. Many are related to HPV. So the hope is that we'll be able to do cancer prevention with this vaccine for both men and women.
My guest is Dr. Terry Frankovich from the Western UP Health Department. We're talking about kids' health, as, particularly as it relates to the kids going back to school over the next few days. Suppose I'm a young parent, Terry, and I don't have a lot of financial resources. I don't have health insurance. How do I pay for, how do I get my kids these vaccines?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the really good news these days is that there really shouldn't be any financial barriers to getting children vaccinated for a couple of reasons. One is the state, for a long time now, has had a program called VFC, or Vaccines for Children, and that has provided vaccines basically free of charge to families where financial barriers were an issue, and allowed that so that all children could be up to date on vaccination. Now with the Affordable Care Act, the great thing is that the insurance programs are supposed to cover preventative care, so that vaccinations typically are better covered now for most families, for adults and children, the vaccines that are indicated.
There are people who are reluctant to have their children vaccinated, and I know there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that many people think, or at least some people think, that the vaccines themselves cause health problems. I've seen study after study that seem to disprove that, but this seems to hang on, doesn't it?
It really does, and you know, we talk about that it's sort of hard to unring that bell. And I think the classic issue with this was the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And you probably remember when there was a lot of media hoopla related to some research that came out of England about a possible link between measles vaccine and autism. And that really frightened parents and caused a lot of decline in acceptance of that vaccine, even though it was critically important. Since then, that research has been shown to be basically fabricated, and the gentleman, the physician, was prosecuted for that, publishing that research and the way that was presented. But it's much harder to get people to hear that part of the message. And so it's been one of our jobs is to try and really get that out there, that the vaccine, not only that vaccine, but all of these vaccines are incredibly safe and very effective.
Are there any risks involved? Can you catch measles from getting the measles vaccine, or catch polio from getting the polio vaccine?
No, there really isn't a risk of that. And, you know, with all vaccines, you know, we talk about risks. Most typically in any vaccine, the biggest risk is an allergic reaction, and obviously that's very rare. Other things like soreness, a little fever, those types of things are relatively common. But for normal, healthy individuals, vaccines are not something that are going to cause illness. Now, if you took someone who was severely immune compromised and they had, a measles vaccine, that might cause problems. But for healthy individuals, live virus vaccines are fine, and actually for the majority of people in our country. Inactivated vaccines like DPT, those are never a risk. In terms of transmitting disease.
I know there are other parents who maybe have spiritual, religious reasons for not wanting to have their kids vaccinated. What happens when that child gets to school and has not been vaccinated?
Well, it actually really is a problem. The way we keep the numbers of these cases down in the community is having what we call herd immunity, meaning that so many people are immune out there that it's very hard to spread an illness throughout a community. Every person who's not immunized or is not immune has a potential to become infected and to spread that to people who have other people who have not been vaccinated, who can't be vaccinated because of their age. Some vaccines aren't appropriate, for instance, for children under a year. but they can still become sick with the illness. So those having those children, for instance, present in the school does create a risk for other children in the classroom and other families in the community. So we really do encourage vaccination for everyone. I would argue that nowadays, very few of the waivers that parents sign for vaccination are related to religious preferences. I think a lot of it is related to parents being worried and not accessing good, credible information about vaccines, both risk and benefit.
There are some vision and hearing screenings that the Western UP Health Department will be offering next week for kids who are going into kindergarten and also kids of kindergarten age who may be starting on a homeschool track. What do you look for when you start to assess a child for hearing and vision issues?
Sure. Part of it depends on age, but the health department does do hearing and vision screening actually within the school setting as well as in the office. And so when we're looking at vision screening for children, for example, we're really looking for a couple things. One is to make sure that the muscles that move the eye are balanced so that children are getting a clear single picture when they're looking. Because screening is very important for that, because sometimes those muscle imbalances can lead to decreased vision in the eye if they persist for long enough. And there are things that can be done to correct it. The other thing we're looking for is just that visual acuity. You know, are kids seeing well enough to be able to do well in school? If a child sitting in a classroom can't see what's happening on the board, they're not going to do as well, obviously. So that's very important.
It's got to be challenging to try to figure out whether a child has a hearing problem or particularly a visual problem, because if the child has had this since birth, they don't necessarily realize there's a problem.
Well, that's true, and I think, you know, it's interesting if you watch vision screening done in very young children, you know, kids who can't read, for instance, a letter chart, we do it with pictures so that they can name the pictures that they're seeing and some other sort of subtle ways to be able to look. There are some vision and hearing screening tools that are more passive that can do an assessment even without cooperation from the child other than basically being still. And those are helpful as well, particularly sometimes for children with developmental delays who really have difficulty participating.
Are there things that parents can watch for in terms of hearing and vision that might raise some red flags?
Sure. With vision, what we're looking at are certainly if parents notice what we call lazy eye, where sometimes parents will notice this in, say, a photograph where a child maybe doesn't have a straight glance with both eyes. One eye turns in or out a little bit. And so sometimes parents will bring that to the attention of a primary care provider and are a good screen for their child. Also, parents can look, you know, if they're seeing children squinting hard to be able to see something or, you know, holding things closer or further away from their face to be able to see, it can certainly be a good clue. With hearing, the typical issue is speech development. So in very young children, one of the things we always want to be looking at is hearing acuity in children who seem to be having some speech delays or problems with clarity of their speech.
Sure, because if the child can't hear the speech appropriately, the child can't repeat the speech appropriately.
Exactly. And then so that works for children who have congenital or inborn problems with their hearing. Also, sometimes for children, if they have persistent ear infections or recurrent ear infections, that can compromise their hearing, at least temporarily. And so parents may notice some differences. All of a sudden, a child who's been hearing normally, who has the TV blasting or music blasting, other than teenagers, because they do that anyway. But they're really, those cues can tell you, oh, maybe, you know, he just had an ear infection and now he's really not hearing well. For most kids, that hearing issue will disappear as the infection resolves. But for some kids, it can be persistent for some time.
These screenings for kids of kindergarten age will be held at the Hancock office of the Western UP Health Department on Tuesday and Wednesday this week, at the Lantz office on Thursday, and at the Onondaga office on Friday. And if you want to schedule an appointment, the number to call is 482-7382, 482-7382. How often should older kids get vision and hearing screening?
Well, actually, again, the health department does this in the schools, and for what will happen is, in ideally, they should be getting a routine well-child checkup every year in older children. Younger children get them more frequently. And as part of that well-child exam, there should be screening questions that check about hearing and vision. And in most of those well-child exams, there'll be some type of a vision screen as well. They don't always do hearing screens during those visits, but at intervals during their school career, children will be screened, usually by health department staff within the school setting.
Okay. We have had, over the last few years, a lot of flu days in the school. We have had a lot of flu, or what they tend to call flu-like symptoms. Should kids have flu shots?
Absolutely. Everyone over the age of 6 months is recommended to have a flu shot. The only exception would be someone who has had severe allergic reactions to eggs or to a previous vaccine. But basically, everyone is recommended to get it. And it's a great prevention tool. Flu vaccines have been around for a very long time, have a great safety track record. And in years where the vaccine strains are well matched to what ends up circulating in the community, the vaccine is very effective at lowering the amount of disease within the community.
So my child is sick. When should my child not go to school? Where do I draw the line?
Well, for most people, an easy call is a child who's running a fever, and for two reasons. One is, for most illnesses, you are most contagious during that fever period of the illness, but also because most kids just don't feel well enough to participate when they're running a fever. The other types of things would be even in the preschool age child, kids who just really don't feel well enough to participate and get anything out of the school day. Children who are having symptoms like vomiting or diarrhea, where they really can't get through the school day without a lot of difficulty, are also. But for most kids, mild colds, even mild rashes, that type of thing, it's perfectly fine for them to be in school.
Because I know it's challenging for parents these days, particularly if mom and dad both work or in single-parent households. The child is sick, it causes a major inconvenience, and I suspect that there's a tendency maybe to say, well, take a few more of these Tylenols or
right.
Advils or something, and let's get you off to school. Is there a point at which child might be infecting the other kids at school?
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I think, again, during that fever period, they're more likely to be more highly contagious, and it is partly how we see things spread through that school setting, so that, when we're talking about these kids all sitting in classrooms together, all handling desks and doorknobs and banisters and all of those things, it's a really effective way to spread illness within that setting.
So what do we do as parents to help the kids keep healthy in that germ-filled environment? Do we have to send, the hand sanitizer with them and things like that?
Well, actually, I think the main thing is, number one, keeping the kids home when they really are too ill to be in school. The other thing is, for the most common illnesses, which are going to be colds for most children, teaching kids to do those very easy things like coughing into their sleeve, washing their hands frequently, disposing of Kleenexes rather than, carrying them around in their pockets or reusing them. Those types of things can help to decrease the spread within a school setting.
Do the supplements that are on the market work with kids, the vitamin C supplements, the zinc tablets, or frankly, do they work with anybody, really?
Well, there's not a whole lot of evidence that those types of supplements make a big difference in outcomes. There have been some studies that suggested things like zinc may shorten the course of something by a small amount. But in general, my recommendation to parents is that they basically try and feed their children a well-balanced diet at all times. And certainly, a daily multivitamin is perfectly fine for children, but mega-dosing on things like vitamin C or zinc is not likely to make a big difference in their health.
If parents have questions about the health of their child, and maybe they don't have access to a primary care provider for whatever reason, how should they proceed to get those questions answered?
Well, I think, obviously the easiest thing and most direct thing is if you do have a health care provider that you can consult with any questions, I also think for parents, most people have accessibility to online resources now, and I would recommend to any parent two sites. One is the American Academy of Pediatrics, which I believe is AAP.org. They have a lot of materials on there for parents about common childhood illnesses, immunizations, many behavioral topics as well. So there's a lot of good, credible information on there.
And the other one, real quickly, because we're just about out of time.
Sure. CDC.gov.
All right.
Stands for Centers for Disease Control.
All right.
Good information on infectious illness.
Thank you, Dr. Terry Frankovich from the Western UP Health Department. Take care. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks so much.
And stay tuned because Copper Country Today continues in just a moment.